something about, okay, what's the subspace where we expect this to be true, how unique are these operators? So the slogan for today is that I'm going to try and characterize everything in terms of information. So in particular, the information of whether I acted with this operator or not in the bulk, how that information is encoded in the CFT. I'm going to try and encode it by asking a simple question, by saying, okay, say that, you know, I was mischievous and I only gave you access to part of the boundary quantum state. I didn't give you the entire state in the CFT Hilbert space. I only gave you the density matrix on some subregion. Then, given that quantum state, could you figure out whether I acted with this phi or not? Okay? That's a way of trying to get a better handle of how this information about 5x is actually encoded in the CFT state from the point of view of the spatial locality in the CFT at fixed time. Now, that way of phrasing the problem is something that anyone here who does quantum information knows very well. That's quantum error correction. It's exactly saying, I send you some quantum state, but then some of it gets lost in the mail, and can we still recover the message? That's the standard problem of decoding the erasure channel quantum information theory. In ADS-CFT terminology, this question has been asked before, less precisely than I'm going to ask it today, and it's been gone under the general description of subregion duality. So, you know, I give you a subregion in the CFT. What bulk region, if any, can I describe given access just to the quantum state on that subregion? And then I'm going to tell you that you should really define this as quantum error correction, really quantum erasure correction. In order to do this, though, I'm going to need a few tools, some from ADS-CFT, some from quantum information theory. So what I'm going to do is now just sort of start introducing things. And then hopefully, you know, at some time that's not too close to the end of the talk, we'll be able to put everything together into a picture of, for example, how the paradox I suggested before is resolved. And also sort of more generally, I would say, an intuitive picture of at least a partial, not quite answer, but a partial understanding of how holography works on a fixed time slice. You know, how is this information actually encoded in the boundary theory? Okay, so that's the sort of motivational stuff. Now, so let's first start on the bulk side. So let's think about, well, the ADS-CFT side, so bulk reconstruction. So there's a fairly standard, actually, way of trying to extend this dictionary back into the bulk, which is based on the idea, of solving the bulk equations of motion as operator equations in the CFT. So you take this as a boundary condition, So now including the time direction, so I guess if I'm drawing, including the time direction, the ADS or something like that, the idea is to use the boundary conditions as operator boundary conditions and then solve equations of motion into the bulk as operator equations to find some operator expression in the CFT of some bulk operator sitting there. So this is a well-studied problem. The kinds of results you find is that, so say this is phi of x here, then you find some integral plus order 1 over n. So here, y is a boundary point. I guess that's consistent with what I said here. Maybe the capitalization isn't consistent, but forgive me. So this is some kernel, k. It's a function that you can compute. You can figure out what the function is. You integrate it against the single trace primary, which is dual to phi, on the boundary against this kernel. And there's a little bit of choice about what exactly you do with this kernel. But perhaps the nicest choice that people usually use is that you choose the kernel to only be non-zero on the boundary at points which are space-like separated from this point. So you have an integral over some region like that on the boundary. Now note that this construction is based on the assumption that there is an operator in the CFT that obeys the bulk equations of motion, and recall that I was warning you that that's not necessarily in general a safe assumption to make like that, okay? But if it exists, then this is the formula for it. And then it's an explicit formula. So we can check that it actually does. Of course, you have to obey the equations of motion non-trivially, you need to work out the one over n fractions, but those indeed can be worked out. And you can see that at least formally in perturbation theory, this thing obeys the equation of motion. So this is called the global reconstruction of the operator phi of x. It's simple, so notice it's shockingly simple in some sense, right? I mean, it's just a single integral against some CFT primary operator. If you tried to express it entirely in terms of Schrodinger picture operators on a fixed time slice, it would not be so simple, right? You would have to do Heisenberg evolution to move these guys all down to the same point, and that would generate all kinds of, you know, multi-trace operators and higher non-localities. So and that's the picture I'm going to want. I'm going to want to think of everything on a fixed time slice. So then for our purposes today, we can just draw it from the top. We have some operator here, and then we can imagine that there's some messy operator with support everywhere on the boundary at a fixed time that represents this operator. Okay. Let's see. Maybe I'll do this. Inconsistency in this. Now, there's another thing that you can do, though. So this is the simplest way of representing this operator. But actually, there's another way of doing it. So this is a representation that uses all the points on the boundary that are space-like separated from the operator. But actually, there's another way of doing this where you only need to use a spatial part of the boundary to represent the operator. So the idea is that in ADS CFT, there's something called the ADS Rindler wedge. So in the simplest example, you take a fixed t equals zero slice, and you cut it in half. You roughly shoot null geodesics up here, like that. There's a more precise definition of this, but this will do for getting on with. This defines a diamond-shaped region on the boundary, and then it defines a wedge in the bulk that sort of interpolates between this diamond-shaped region on the boundary and this surface here in the bulk where I cut the slice into two parts. So this region is called the causal wedge of A, where A is this boundary interval here. There's a more general covariant definition of it that works in any space-time, but I'm not going to get into it because it's not really going to matter. But then the upshot of this is that, so for any subregion A on the boundary, you can define some bulk region, the causal wedge of A, such that there's a formula similar to this one, but where as long as X is inside of this wedge, I only need to have the integral y be over this diamond-shaped region on the boundary, which is the boundary of the causal wedge. Okay. So technically, this diamond-shaped region is called D of A. It's the domain of dependence of A in the boundary theory. So if any of you are relativists, I guess you know what that means. It's the set of points in the boundary whose Cauchy evolution, if I specify initial data on A, then the Cauchy evolution completely fixes the solutions everywhere within D of A. So in this ADS Rindler construction, we can write the same formula, phi of x, but now we need to have the integral only be over D of A. So this is called the ADS Rindler
reconstruction.
The only real technical subtlety here is that this K is a much more difficult object to deal with. So they're not the same K, they're different Ks. So maybe let's call this K hat or something. And this K is actually does not exist as a function. It exists only as a distribution. So you have to be careful about using it. But OK, fine. It's not going to matter for us. So let's just pretend that it's a function. OK.
So that means the x is inside the wedge?
Yeah, so yeah, good. Now x has to be inside the wedge. So good. Yeah, so x element of this implies that. Yeah.
The kernel diverges, or?
So if you try and write the kernel in position space, then it diverges. So the way you have to interpret this formula is that you, first of all, like with any local field operator, you should always smear phi against some test functions. And then secondly, you should think of as being an object inside of expectation values in the CFT. And with those two caveats, then the integral always makes sense.
And the test function has to all lie inside this W.
That's correct, yeah. The test function should be some C infinity bound function. Okay. Now, using this, I can introduce a couple new paradoxes which are reminiscent of the one I described at the beginning. One of them will be basically the same, but which are a little more precise. The way that you get into confusing things with this is that the same x lies in the causal wedge for different a's. Okay. So paradox one. So let's say here's x. Now let's pick your favorite boundary operator, your favorite local boundary operator. And since I'm in charge here today, I'm going to have your favorite local boundary operator be here. But it could be somewhere else. I just happen to pick there. Now the point is I can pick a region A where I just remove a small piece around this operator, and then A is going to be the rest of this. And then the intersection of the causal wedge of A with this time slice is going to be this whole thing here. So in particular, it's going to contain x. And that means that phi of x has a representation in the CFT, which has no support whatsoever where O is located. Okay. So maybe to unwrap the boundary here and make that a little more clear. So say here's the boundary cylinder. I unwrapped it. Here's D of A. Here's A. Here's the Cauchy slice. Here's the Cauchy slice on the boundary. That's the boundary of this bulk Cauchy slice. Here's A. This diamond here is D of A. And then by using the CFT Hamiltonian, I can, you know, again, the operator started as being represented everywhere here, but I can evolve it back so that it's just represented there. And then O maybe is over here somewhere. Here's O of X. But then this operator manifestly computes with O exactly in the CFT because the support of the operator has no support in the region where O is defined. But then remember, I can do this for any O. So if each of these, you know, so if all of these different representations of phi were actually equal as operators in the CFT, then we would be in contradiction with that theorem that I mentioned in the beginning. Okay? Now, so that would certainly make you suspect that these phis aren't all really going to be equal as operators, which is a bit surprising because in the bulk they certainly are equal. They're just Bogdanov-Lubov transformations, which are just different representations of the same bulk operator in terms of different creation annihilation operators. That's the sort of bulk picture of how you relate k hat and k. Now we can make the case a little bit more strongly. So we can consider a situation where I've got two overlapping regions, A and B. So maybe A is like this, and B is like that. So then the boundaries of the causal wedges are like that for A and B. And now I can be clever. I can put the operator here so that it's in the causal wedge of A, and it's in the causal wedge of B, but it's not in the causal wedge of A intersect B. Okay. So that would make you suggest that think that there's no representation of this. So if these two operators were to be equal at a fixed time in the CFT, the only way could be if they really both only had support in A intersect B. But A intersect B can't reconstruct the operator. In fact, the complement of A intersect B can reconstruct the operator, and as we'll see later, or maybe we won't because we won't have time, but essentially a version of the no-cloning theorem tells you that if I can represent the operator here, then this region has no information about it whatsoever. Okay. So again, somehow if you like phi sub A, is sort of not really equal to phi sub B as precise CFT operators. Now, an even more fun example, just to really drill this home, and also because this one we're going to see in a sec in a simple example. So good. Now let's do something even crazier. Let's consider three regions, A, B, and C. And now let's consider the operator in the center here. So this operator has no representation in any one of the wedges. There's no phi A, there's no phi B, there's no phi C. So where's the operator, right? Well, it does have representations either as phi AB, as phi BC, or as phi AC. And clearly those aren't going to all be the same operator. I mean, if they were, they'd have to be defined on the mutual intersection of all of them, which is just these three points, which is silly. And even if you were going to hold out for that, then I'd just do another one where I rotate it a little bit, and now the intersection would be empty. And I think this is what the bulk is telling us. So now we'd like to understand what does this mean in the CFT? What's going on here? So my claim is that what's going on here is quantum error correction. And that's a subject to which I will now turn to try and convince you of that. So now, for the people who already know quantum error correction, I'm sorry that it's 10 or 15 minutes will be a bit boring for you. I will present it in my own somewhat bizarre way, so hopefully it will amuse you, if nothing else. Okay, so let me start with a simple example. The basic idea is, Alice wants to send Bob a quantum state in the mail. She's worried that some parts of the state are going to be stolen. What can she do to make sure that Bob still gets the state? I think it's best to give a simple example. So the example I'm going to use is going to involve what are called qutrits. Those are just three-state qubits, for anyone who doesn't know. And I'm going to describe how Alice can send one qutrit to Bob by using three qutrits in such a way that if Bob loses any one of the three qutrits, he can still recover the quantum state. And you should roughly have this picture in mind as I explain this. Okay, so what's the idea? So Bob wants to send a state psi, which is a sum on I from 0 to 2 of C sub I. Okay, that's a state of a single qutrit. I think Alice wants to send to Bob. Okay, fine. I forget what the conventions are here, but okay. So then what Alice does is she sends Bob psi tilde, which is a superposition of three states with the same coefficients, but the states are going to be I tildes, and there are going to be states in a three-qutrit Hilbert space. What they are going to be explicitly I think actually maybe this code was invented by Daniel Gottesman. So in the spirit of Adam's talk, this is great work done by heroes of Perimeter Institute. Not totally sure. I think it was. Right, so this is some GHZ kind of state. Plus 1, 2, 0, plus 2, 0, 1. And then 2 tilde, you can probably guess. So I'll write it a little more heuristically. It's going to be 0, 2, 1, permutations, plus 2 cyclic permutations. Okay. Now, what's the benefit of doing it this way? Well, certainly one nice thing about these states is that it's symmetric between the three qubits. They're highly entangled. In fact, you can check that on any one of the qutrits. Any state that's a superposition of these three will always be maximally mixed on any one of the qutrits. But the real deal is that the reason why we like these states is because there exists a unitary matrix, U12, which acts only on the first two qutrits and has the property that if I give to it an I tilde, it spits back an I on the first qutrit times some state chi on the second and third qutrits, where the state chi is some state that's independent of I. So it's just always going to be 1, 1 plus 2, 2. So Alice sends Bob this state, and then say the third qutrit gets lost. Well, what Bob can do is he can take the state that Alice sent him, he can act on it with his U12, since he's got the first two qutrits in his hands, and then he just gets back the state psi times chi. And so then he gets the state back directly in his first qutrit, so he's happy, he got the message. And then clearly by the symmetry, you can do the same. There's also going to be a U13 and a U23. Okay, and if you're dying to know what it is, you can work it out yourself. What the U is, you can work it out yourself, or you can ask me after the talk. Okay. Now, this is the story if Bob is trying to recover a state where, you know, up here we were talking about operators. We weren't directly talking about states. But there's a simple relationship. So indeed, say that now. I'm going to say operators. Okay. So say that I have an operator O, which is a single qutrit operator, and it acts on the single qutrit Hilbert space. Like that. Then. Clearly, we can define an encoded O operator, O tilde, which acts on the encoded I just in the same way, with the same matrix elements. So I guess this is sometimes called a dressed operator. So this is an operator on the space of one qutrit. This is an operator on the space of three qutrits. But this implements the same transformation on the single qutrit subspace of the three qutrit Hilbert space that we're interested in. The subspace is called the code subspace. I'll refer to it that way in the future. Now, of course, this I can do for any subspace. But usually this O tilde is going to have support, non-trivial support on all three of the qutrits. It's not, for example, only going to have support on the first two qutrits or the second two qutrits. It's just going to be some operator that acts non-locally on all three of the qutrits. But actually, because we've carefully chosen these three such that this U exists, then we can actually define an operator O12 as follows. We define it as U12 dagger O1 U12. Now, what does this operator do? It takes a state psi tilde. It maps that state onto the first qutrit like this. Then it acts with this operator O just on the first qutrit, which is something you can do on the first qutrit, and then it re-encodes. Okay? So this is an operator acting just on the first two qutrits, but with the property that O12 acting on psi tilde equals O tilde acting on psi tilde. So any operator which acts on a single qutrit can be realized as an operator just on the first two qutrits because of the existence of this U12. And again, by the symmetry, there must then also exist an O13 and an O23. Okay, and this should be pretty reminiscent of that, right? So now we're in basically the same kind of situation. We've got there was up here we had phi AB, phi BC, and phi AC. Here we've got O12, O23, and O13.
So my claim is going to be that this toy model is actually what's going on. Of course, not the toy model, but the idea of the toy model is the same phenomenon that we're encountering here in ADS-CFT.
So the idea is that those three are equal to each other, phi A, B, and phi B, C, and phi A, C?
No. No. So 012 here is an operator that acts on only the first two qutrits, whereas 023 would be an operator that acts only on the second and the third qutrit. So they can't be as equal as operators on the full Hilbert space of three qutrits. They're equal as operators acting on the code subspace only.
So they
are not equal as operators in the 27-dimensional three-qutrit Hilbert space. They have different. Yes, they're equal in the sense that if I act with 012 on any state in the subspace spanned by these three states, then it's going to be equal to 013 acting on the same state, or 023 acting on the same state. That's the sense in which they're equal, and the claim is going to be that's the sense in which you should understand any of these bulk algebra facts in ADS-CFT to be true. Okay, now let me generalize what happened. So obviously this model is too simple to contain the CFT as a special case of it, so I'm going to have to generalize this a bit in order to get something that we can directly apply to ADS-CFT. So let me just quickly formalize what happened here. Okay. So this will be general erasure correction. Okay. So I'm going to go back to qubits, but it doesn't even really need to be qubits, but I'll just use qubits because it's familiar. So say we have a 2 to the k dimensional subspace, H sub C, which I'll call the code subspace, of an n qubit system. Then what we're interested in is say that we lose some collection of L of the qubits. Then what we would like to know is, can we recover from that erasure? Okay. By recover, I mean, does there exist a U acting just on the complement of E, which implements that map? So let me write that a little more formally. So we have some set of encoded states, psi tilde. So psi tilde is some element of this subspace, and it lives in the Hilbert space E times E bar. Okay, E times E bar is our n qubits. I want to know, do we have a U E bar acting on psi tilde such that we get psi of E bar 1. So let's say E bar 1 is the first k qubits of E bar times some state chi on E bar 2 and E. So I will define this as correctability. If such a unitary exists, then this code, meaning the subspace, is correctable for the erasure of E. And it's clearly in the same sense that we had before. I'm going to give three equivalent, necessary, and sufficient conditions for correctability. So far, I just pulled U out of the sky. That wasn't very satisfying. In fact, I didn't even tell you what it was. All three conditions are going to be interesting and have relevance for the bulk. Condition number one. So, okay, so this is if and only if one. So how shall I say this? Good. So I say I introduce a reference system R, which has k qubits. Then I can define a state phi, which is a state in the Hilbert space of R, E, and E bar, up to some normalization, which I guess I'll write, IR, I tilde, E, E bar. Okay, so this is some state in the joint Hilbert space. And then correctability implies that the reduced density matrix on R and E that I compute from phi factorizes into rho r of phi times tensor product rho e of phi. So this is a fairly intuitive condition. It says that the system that I erase, E, is uncorrelated with the reference system that's keeping track of the message. So it's essentially saying that the erased subsystem has no information about which state of the subspace I'm actually in. So that's a fairly intuitive condition. Now, this condition is equivalent also, so I'm not going to prove any of these, I'm just going to tell you, to a second condition, which is that for any operator x sub e acting on e, so any operator that acts on the set that gets erased, the expectation value of x sub e, or the matrix element between any two basis elements of the code space, is diagonal times some overall constant factor. So in other words, it's saying that any operator which acts on the erased subfactor acts as the identity on the code space up to some overall multiplicative factor. Now, this condition two is the one that's usually quoted as being the necessary and sufficient condition for error correction. I don't find it quite as intuitive as the first one. But note that two actually also implies something nice, which is that for any state in the code subspace, the correlation between an operator on the erased part and some logical operator. So here an O tilde is going to be as like here. It's going to be some operator that acts within the code subspace. Then any operator acting in the code subspace, O tilde, has a correlation function with any operator XE, which is zero. So again, this is just saying operators on the thing that gets erased can't be correlated with operators that act on the code subspace. If they were, then you would have information about the code subspace in the thing that gets erased, and that's bad. Okay. This is nice because this is the kind of thing that's easy to compute in the bulk. Correlation functions are things we can, you know, deal with better than things like, you know, the reduced density matrix of some region. Okay. And now finally, And this will be the condition that should be the most recognizable given our discussion so far, hopefully. For any logical operator O, for any operator O which acts on k qubits, there exists an O e bar such that O e bar acting on any state in the code subspace is equal to O tilde acting on the same state. And similarly, for the Hermitian conjugate. Okay. And this is the thing we really want. Okay. So I know now that we're getting deep into the formalism here. So let's recall, right, what we had here was that the idea was what the Rindler reconstruction is telling you is if you lose access to a piece of the boundary, sometimes it's okay because there's a representation of the bulk operator which has support only on the complement of the region you lost. And now we're seeing here that that's basically a necessary and sufficient condition for quantum error correction, right? So it's saying that there's some protected subspace. If any operator on that subspace can be represented just on the complement of something, then that's equivalent to these other things. Okay?
Good.
All right. Now, before I get back to sort of bulk physics, I need to say one more thing, which is that when do we expect these conditions to be satisfied? I told you what they are, but of course, if they're not satisfied in the example that we're interested in, then they're not very interesting, okay? Well, fortunately, we can get a decent sense. So if you look at the definition in terms of this U, right? If we make, so there's two things we can say. One is we can say, okay, usually, let's see, so I have this state phi, right? And if it's a reasonable code, if it's a code that makes use of all of the n qubits in some non-trivial way, then at least the density matrix on E is going to have full rank. If it doesn't, then what that really means is that we should just throw out some of the qubits because they're irrelevant and start over and reduce the size of the system until that's true. Okay? If that's true, then in order to be able to produce this state chi and the state psi, we need that the dimensionality of E2 bar has to be greater than or equal to the dimensionality of E. Because because that chi up there is a pure quantum state. And so if rho E has full rank, then it can't be purified by E bar 2 unless the dimensionality of E bar 2 is at least as big as the dimensionality of E. If that's not true, then we're never going to find a U that does this. Okay? So we can figure out what this means in terms of N and L and K. Okay, so what this means is that we need n to be greater than or equal to k plus 2l. And this is a very intuitive statement. It's saying that, you know, if you want to have a bigger message by increasing k, and you want to be able to correct for bigger erasures, then you're going to need more qubits. All right, and that's very intuitive, right? Because the way that the whole procedure is working is that we have enough room in the Hilbert space that we can deal with the errors and not be defeated by them. Now we can actually understand this in another way, which is that so this is sort of saying that this is at least a necessary condition, but in fact it's typically a sufficient condition. So if you look at this state phi up there, that's a state on R, E, and E bar. Let's say that we just chose that state phi randomly out of the Hilbert space of R, E, and E bar. Then by Page's theorem, we would expect that as long as R, E is small compared to E bar, then the density matrix on R and E will be maximally mixed, which means it will be a product, okay? Which means that condition number one up there will be satisfied, that the code will be correctable. So Page says that typically, as long as we have E bar greater than E times R, we're in good shape. And in fact, this is just again N greater than or equal to K plus 2L. Okay, so on average, unless we're doing something weird, this is what we want, this is what we need, and this is enough. Okay? I'm going to match this to bulk physics soon, so just remember that. K plus 2L. All right, and now I've used all the boards.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, absolutely.
So you said typically that's true.
Yeah.
Aren't there some assumptions going into that?
Yeah, so in Page's theorem, the typicality is that I choose phi randomly from the harm measure on n plus k qubits.
So why would that be in any way reasonable for...
Good. So, of course, for many questions, it's an utterly unreasonable assumption to make, okay? But in Page's theorem, actually, so Page's theorem does not need to actually rely on Haar typicality. So I don't know how much you know about these things, but do you know what a unitary 2 design is?
Yeah.
So that's sufficient for this to work.
Right, but if you're talking about ground states of field theories or something close to ground states of field theories, then good. That's very far from...
Absolutely. No, that's relevant, and let me talk about it at the end, though, because I'm going to discuss exactly that. Yeah. Yeah, certainly typical states in that sense are volume law and do all sorts of crazy things. Yeah, don't worry, I'm not going to do anything like that. Yeah, okay. All right. Now, I'm almost ready to go back to the bulk. Let's see. Let's go back to the bulk. We're going to need to put a Band-Aid on this formalism later because this fact that the correlation functions need to be zero is going to be a little bit troublesome in the bulk. But I don't want to bore people who came here expecting to learn about ADS-CFT, so let me discuss that first. Okay, so now, as you have no doubt guessed, the idea is going to be to interpret the ADS-Rindler reconstruction, this phi A, as just being this O E bar. Okay? It'll be the realization of some logical operator on a code subspace that corrects for the erasure of some boundary region. So one consequence of this is pretty straightforward in the bulk. Okay, back. So one consequence is that now here's our bulk spatial slice again, and let's say let's start with a bulk operator here. Okay, say phi of x is here. This is not a very well protected piece of quantum information, because I could just erase this tiny little region on the boundary, and I would no longer be able to reconstruct that operator. Okay, it would be lost because this operator has a representation on this tiny little region. So then by the no cloning argument, which I didn't quite give, but which you can prove in this formalism, it can't have any representation on the complement.
Isn't ADS homogeneous?
Good. So I have to pick a conformal frame at the boundary for small and big to make sense. So moreover, for the radial direction to make sense, right? So yeah, the idea is I pick a conformal frame at the boundary with a round metric, and then that I stick to that. So then that defines what big and small means on the sphere, and also what near the center and near the boundary means in the bulk. So this little operator here is not very well protected. Whereas if I considered some bulk operator here, then we can have, well, rather gigantic erasures that are always correctable. So this operator here is very well protected. So if you like, this makes the connection with the RG a little more precise, right? Because the RG says somehow that this operator is contained in the IR, degrees of freedom at the boundary. So if I delete a little bit of short distance information here or there, it's not going to cause trouble in terms of understanding this operator. But now the quantum error correction formalism makes that very precise. It says, what are the regions you need? What are the regions that you don't need? And when you say need, you really mean something precise. You mean having a CFT operator that actually represents this bulk operator. Okay, so good. So location in the radial direction, it's mapped to the level of protection against small errors. The bigger errors you're protected against, the further in you are. Okay. Now, to make this more precise, we should actually define what the code subspace is. So far, I've just been drawing pictures. There are various ways to do it. I think the most natural there'll be more than one. We define it based on what we're interested in. So let's say, for example, we're interested in some collection of operators near the center, and we're interested in states that are close to the vacuum, that differ from the vacuum by acting with these operators. So then the idea is that I take the code space to be the linear span. There must be some terminology for that, but I'll just call it linear span of the vacuum in the CFT, a state where I get, good. So now I pick, so I'll write phi I of x here, acting on the vacuum, where phi I of x is some local operator in the bulk which I specified beforehand. So I pick some finite collection of local bulk operators that I just, those are the ones that I happen to be interested in. It's tempting to call it an algebra of operators, although it's not quite going to be an algebra, as we'll see in a sec. And then I just act on the vacuum with some of the operators in the allowed set. With a rule that I'm not allowed to act with too many. So you're allowed to act with at most d max. So okay, so up to d max phi's, where d max is up to us to choose. But for your intuition, you should roughly think of it as being of order some positive power of n, but not too large. You know, at most some positive power of n, but we'll discuss in detail more how big it can actually be. So this defines some subspace.
Sorry, what's n?
Good. N is the central charge of the CFT, or it's the n of SUN. I think probably the best thing is that some power of n, which depends exactly on the theory we're talking about, is the radius of ADS in Planck units. Okay. So it's a measure of how semi-classical the theory is. If n is 1, then we don't expect to have anything like bulk effective locality present. So it's going to be something that's going to be present when n is large. Okay. Good. Now, and importantly, these phis I'm going to define using the global representation. So it's the, maybe I covered up the global representation. Let's see. Oh, no, I must have erased the global representation. It was right here. Yeah. The global representation. The one that involves all points that are spaced like separated from this one on the boundary. So it's not restricted to any subregion in the boundary. Now, given the subspace, we then ask, okay, so that defines the code subspace. And now we can ask what set of erasures are correctable given this code subspace. And that's the answer, that's the question which is answered exactly by the ADS-Rindler reconstruction. It tells you, and more than tells you, it constructs for you the operators phi, which act on certain subregions. But then once as the subregion gets smaller and smaller, eventually the operator leaves the causal wedge, and then we can no longer correct for the erasure. Okay. Now, there's one small subtlety with that, which is that these phis aren't actually operators on the code subspace. So they're not actually O's of the type that I was talking about here. And the reason is because I had to put this stupid cutoff here. And once I put that there, then if I keep acting with phi, sooner or later I'm going to act with one too many phis, and it's going to take me out of the code subspace. Now, to deal with what?
Why did you have to put this constraint? Just to make things funny?
Because if you act with too many phis, you have to start worrying about back reaction, which I'm actually going to talk about soon. But to think of this as being small perturbations, you better not put too many phis. That's right. For example, in n equals 4, once you have of order n squared of them, then interesting things start happening. So this is just a technical annoyance, and the way to deal with it is to, if I take a phi and I sandwich it by projection operators onto the code subspace, which are operators that exist in the Hilbert space of the CFT, although they're not particularly nice operators, then I now have operators that act within a subspace. And moreover, as long as I take d max to be reasonably large, then certainly in expectation values of phis low down on the chain, the projectors are irrelevant. Okay, so that's
Can we think of d max as the distance of the code?
It's close. Yeah, it's going to be related to that, indeed. Yeah. I'm going to make that a little more explicit at the end, which will come soon. Okay. So now, maybe let me make one more comment before I get to that, and maybe this will just be a comment, and I won't get into it in complete detail. Now, if you've been paying very careful attention, you might actually start worrying now, if you've carefully processed every symbol on the board. And the reason is that, so let's say that this region here, A, is the region I keep, and then I erase A bar. I guess tragically that's inconsistent with the bars that I wrote with the E's here. But maybe let's be consistent. So I have access to A bar. Well, then it's not because. But I think I'm going to say we keep A and we erase A bar. Okay, and you'll have to follow me. So then here's some operator which I can reconstruct on A. Over here is some operator that I can reconstruct on A bar. And according to condition number 2, operators on the thing I can correct can't be correlated with operators on the thing that I erase. Whereas here, they're obviously correlated. These guys are correlated in the bulk. Okay? This is a bulk correlation function. These operators don't have to be very far from each other. And so that smells like trouble. That sounds like we're in deep doo-doo because we're going to be inconsistent with condition number 2, which is equivalent to conditions 1 and 3, and therefore we're screwed. Now, I don't have time to explain in detail how this is resolved, but let me just say in words what the resolution is. The problem here is that, so condition number 3 seems like a thing we really want, okay? But condition 3 is actually too strong, because condition 3 says for any operator on the code subspace, we can do this reconstruction. Whereas there are operators acting on this code subspace which are not local operators. There are operators acting on this code subspace, which in fact you do not expect to be interpretable in terms of being made out of local operators acting just on this side. So the thing you really want is you want this to hold for some subalgebra of O's, which correspond to local operators in this side of the wedge. Okay? And once you drop the demand that this holds for all operators, you say it only holds for some operators. Now you can study what are the conditions that this holds only for a subalgebra. And that introduces something called operator algebra quantum error correction, which was introduced by Benny Krampf and Graham and Cribbs, I think. I forget. One of them is a perimeter person. I think Krampf is a perimeter person. And that's a version where you only protect a subalgebra, and then miraculously you find, although I don't have time to explain, that in that version of things, correlation is allowed. And the thing that becomes your new rule for when things are correctable is exactly that any operator on the code subspace is correctable if and only if it commutes within the code subspace with any operator that acts on the erased qubits. And that's exactly what's true here in the bulk. So any operator here is going to commute with an operator there by space-like separation, and that's precisely the necessary and sufficient condition for operator algebra quantum error correction. Okay, so that went by fast. If you want to know more, ask me afterwards. Okay, so now let me close by understanding a bit more what's going on with this Dmax. Let's see. I don't want to erase that. That's very important. So I think I'll put this up. Oh. Hello, Kevin. Is Kevin still here? Maybe I'll just do that. Okay. And unfortunately, Kevin is... I feel for Kevin, but you know, time is limited. All right. So now the problem here is that what happens if we make Dmax too large? Indeed, what happens is that we start having to deal with back reaction. So we can try and be quantitative about this by matching onto this n has to be greater than k plus 2l and comparing that to the bulk. So let's be very concrete. Let's pick our set of operators to be localized within one ADS radius in the center of the bulk. The representation of these operators in the CFT does not care about any short wavelength modes in the CFT. We can integrate out everything whose wavelength is parametrically shorter than the sphere at the boundary. So then the number of degrees of freedom, the total number of degrees of freedom with which we're doing the encoding is roughly the zero modes of the CFT, which scales like n squared. Okay. Now here I'm doing the n equals 4 theory. in 3 plus 1 dimensions, just to be very concrete. So now, if we look at this inequality, so let's start by considering the case where dmax is small. So morally, that's like saying k is small, right? Because dmax was the thing that controlled the dimensionality of the code subspace. Well, when k is small, then what this inequality tells us is just that we need L to be less than n over 2. So it tells us that we basically need access to half of the boundary. As long as I erase something that's less than half of the boundary, then I'm going to be able to find a representation on the complement. And that's actually exactly what the ADS-Rindler construction is telling us, right? So if we, you know, if we say we erased this whole thing, then the Rindler wedge would be like that, and we would no longer have access to the center, right? Whereas if we erased this, then this is the Rindler wedge, and we do have access to the center. So that's consistent. This inequality is consistent with the ADS-Rindler construction in that limit. But now let's start cranking up k. Let's start trying to make dmax larger and larger. Well, clearly nothing is going to change until dmax becomes of order little n, okay? So, well, really until k, which is basically dmax, becomes of order little n. So what we find is that when k becomes of order little n, which is big N squared, then we start losing correctability if we fix L, right? So the question I'm imagining asking here is we fix L, so that's like fixing a particular boundary region. And now I crank up k. And then what we expect from this inequality is to say that we're able to see less and less, we're able to see fewer and fewer things in the bulk from a fixed boundary region. We're able to correct for fewer and fewer, you know, correct only a smaller and smaller code. And this is good because this is actually what you expect, right? So when k is of order big N squared, that's exactly when the entropy of this code space becomes large enough that this all these operators acting in the center is just going to produce some gigantic black hole. And the causal wedge, which previously went through here, is now going to get repelled. Okay. So then you can see that there's a nice match between these sort of holographic, this is roughly what's called the holographic bound in the bulk, which says that, you know, entropies can't scale like volumes, they have to scale like areas if you try and put too much stuff all at the same place. So that's a sort of well-known bulk fact, but here we're seeing it coming out of the theory of quantum error correction. So then I think the conclusion would be, okay, so I think what we're making here is a picture of how holography works. Maybe not in detail, but at least some aspects of holography, how they work. You know, we're seeing the emergence of the radial direction. We're seeing the holographic bound. There are still, you know, of course, we'd like to make it more and more precise. One direct interesting direction, which I'm currently working on with the people I erased, is in the context of Mira trying to construct error-correcting codes explicitly that behave in the way that I've advocated here. And we've had some success in doing that. I think also there are various questions which I didn't have time to get into. For there's a debate about can you reconstruct in the causal wedge or all the way to the entanglement wedge, which Rob Myers is one of the people who thinks about that. I think that question is answerable in this formalism. I'm optimistic that we'll continue learning new things, you know, getting a better picture of what's going on. All right, thanks.
So the stuff at the end about gravitational back reaction, the gravitational back reaction in the bulk corresponds to a constraint on how many operators you can measure.
That's right.
Is that something that's going to be visible in a mirror analysis, which usually wouldn't do gravitational back reaction?
So I think it should be. That's probably the part that's the hardest to get right. I think the way that back reaction works in Mira is that you start with the network that kind of looks like the hyperbolic plane, which is describing the ground state of the CFT. And that reminds me about that other question you asked. I integrated out all of the short wavelength modes, and then I only took a typical state amongst the zero modes. So that's why it wasn't a volume law kind of state. Yeah. Sorry, I should have said that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So in Mira, the way that back reaction should work is that I start changing the tensors I start feeding extra information into the tensors to start getting different states other than the ground state. And for a while, I just keep the same network and I keep doing that. But at some point, I'm going to have inserted so much stuff that there's going to be a different network, which is a more efficient way of generating the same state. And then the geometry should be interpreted as the sort of smallest network that you can use to generate the CFT state. So that's actually been worked out semi-quantitatively for a special case of these shells by Lenny and Douglas and Dan Roberts recently. But I think it's indicative of the general way of how you should think about back reaction. But I mean, the fact, for example, that there's this threshold where sort of you there's only so much you can, you know, if you start making the code subspace bigger and bigger, you can correct only for smaller and smaller erasures. That you can see pretty explicitly from the tree, from the neuron tensor network construction.
Okay, any other question? Okay, I think.